Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. The news from Europe these days is gloomy, with words like crisis, collapse, and blow up dominating the headlines. What is happening with the euro crisis? Can the euro and the eurozone be salvaged? And what does all of this mean to our own struggling economy? Joining us to discuss the euro crisis and all that is happening in this very moment is Mauro Guillen. He is a professor of international management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, where he directs the Lauder Institute of Management and International Studies. Mauro, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
And I guess in the interest of full disclosure, we have to mention that Mauro Guillen, you're Spanish, have a Spanish passport, and I am German with a German passport, so we both bring a little bit of a perspective to this discussion. So there are so many things happening all at once, and I wanted to start with the elections in Greece. They are happening this Sunday, and leftist party leader Alex Tsipras, who is very much against the bailout, is up against the New Democracy leader, who is very much pro-bailout. So what is at stake here?
Well, what's at stake is essentially the future of Greece, but also, I think, by implication, the future of the euro project as a whole. And, of course, the leftist party is appealing to populist sentiments in Greece and just telling the Greeks, well, you don't really have to work hard. You know, we'll get some help from Europe, but without the austerity or without the other, you know, changes. And New Democracy, which is a party that is largely very discredited because it hasn't really run the country in the right way over the last 8 years or so, is essentially saying, let's play by the rules, let's acquiesce with the Germans, and so on and so forth. And, well, we still don't know what the outcome is going to be, but quite frankly, I think most people are very pessimistic.
But Tsipras says things like can't pay, won't pay. How do they envision the future of Greece?
Well, this is, you know, not the first time that a country that doesn't have a strong sense of its own role in the global economy has gotten into trouble. I mean, we've had this in Latin America, we had this in Africa, we've had this in Eastern Europe many times over. So Greece's situation is not unique. What makes it unique is that Greece entered the euro system a few years ago. And so they're not, you know, isolated or operating in isolation of the broader European context. And so what happens in Greece, which is a tiny economy, could actually have very much devastating effects throughout not just Europe but all over the world. That's what makes the situation different. Other than that, if the Greeks weren't using the euro as their currency, this would be just another, you know, little problem in a little country. What makes it unique is that they have the euro, and so whatever happens in Greece may have major implications for the viability of the single currency.
How so? What exactly would happen? First of all, can Greece exit? There's not really a provision for a country to leave the eurozone, correct?
Well, not legally.
Yeah.
But essentially, you know, I think this crisis is all about confidence, right? So investors have lost confidence in governments and their ability to pay back their debts. Companies have lost confidence in that they can make money in the marketplace, so they're not investing. Consumers have lost confidence, so they're postponing buying goods if they can, and so on and so forth, right? And nobody, of course, has confidence in the banks anymore. So a Greek exit, especially if it's forced by the markets, would be a highly disruptive event that would only add to that lack of confidence, that would exacerbate the problem. It would just show the world, well, the Europeans cannot fix the situation. And, of course, it would open the door for other countries to also be, in a position in which they have no other option but to also leave. Right?
I want to invite our listeners to join in this conversation with Mauro Guillen. He is professor of international management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, and we're discussing the euro crisis. So if you have a question about anything that is happening in Europe at the moment with the euro, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Also, if you've recently traveled in Europe, are from Europe, want to share some observations about the kind of pulse and mood over there, please give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Now, just to understand better, do Greeks, do you think they have a vision, if they are against the bailout, do they have a vision of a new Greece that maybe doesn't have the euro anymore?
Well, the political leaders don't seem to have such a vision. You see, Greece is a unique country. All countries are unique, right? I mean, the world, of course, is, I think, ruled by the so-called Sinatra principle, right? We all do it our own way. So every country is different, and any attempt to show that, you know, these two countries over here or those two countries over there are the same, it's just bound to fail, right? I mean, it's just all of these differences. And Greece is unique because of its political history. It's unique because for a number of years, you know, they've essentially, you know, run the government and run the country in a way that was detrimental, I think, to their own interests. They've, you know, allowed people to avoid paying taxes and so on and so forth. And it is a country that is having a lot of trouble competing in the global economy. So they have a shipping industry, which is declining. They have tourism, but of course there's a lot of competition from Turkey, from the Balkans, from Italy, from Spain, and so on and so forth. They make some clothing. They have some exports of food. So it's a country that is having a lot of trouble redefining itself in the new global economy and being competitive. And of course, being part of the euro imposes yet another burden, which is they get free money or cheap money, but at the same time, it makes all of the goods and services that they produce very expensive, right? And they're not improving their productivity. They're not getting better at what they're doing because, again, the government has had no plan for that. So Greece, I think, in the context of the peripheral countries in Europe, those at the southern edge of the Union, I think is unique in that it has made almost no progress in terms of becoming more competitive for the last 10 or 15 years. And this is why Greece is likely to be the first country to exit the euro.
If they do exit the euro, who would be the biggest losers in terms of money given to Greece if they default, so to speak, on this big loan?
Well, 2 years ago, it was the German banks, right? So in addition to the Greek banks, it was the German banks up until 2 years ago that owned most of that Greek government debt. But once the problem started, the foreigners, including the German banks, but not only the German banks, also the French banks, the Italian banks, and so on, started to unload their holdings of Greek debt. They started to sell the Greek debt.
To whom?
Well, to essentially Greek banks and to other investors who were, you know, thinking that maybe it would be a good idea to get a bond that was paying a very high interest rate when it was very difficult to find, you know, those returns, right, anywhere else in the world. So, in other words, and this, by the way, has also been going on in Spain and in Portugal and in Ireland and all of the and in Italy, right? So, the government debt has become much more, to a much greater extent, owned by locals, right, rather than by the others. So in other words, the foreigners have been, you know, moving away from the financing of those countries. So, to a very large extent, they're on their own now, and that's why they need a bailout because by themselves they don't seem to be able to get out of the problems they managed to get into.
And how are investors over here watching the Greek elections on Sunday? I've seen a lot of advice online talking about what you need to know about the elections in Greece. So what are people over here afraid of?
Well, here in the United States, of course, it would be a second order effect, right? It would be not the immediate impact because obviously people in the United States, I guess most people, don't have money deposited in Greek banks. They don't have investments in Greece. They don't have real estate. They don't have that, those sorts of things. So it's more the second order impact. Europe happens to be the largest market in the world, right? The European Union, right? It's very large in population. It's a whole bunch of very rich countries. And this is a very important market for U.S. companies of all sorts. A lot of American companies make very hefty profits in Europe. So this is going to have an impact on the U.S. economy in terms of exports, in terms of the profits of American corporations. And it's just going to, once again, increase the level of volatility. And it's going to undermine confidence in the world. And this is the kind of dynamic that we've been trying very hard to get out of over the last 4 years. And again, this will just set us back, you know, a few steps in time. And, you know, this recession, again, is being driven by this lack of confidence. A European meltdown will only add to the volatility and to the problems.
We're talking about the crisis, the euro crisis in the eurozone with Mauro Gillen of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. If you want to join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Before we move on to Spain, what's your take on Alex Tsipras? He is the leftist party leader. He's very handsome. He's young. He's irreverent. He has a lot of appeal. So what's your take on him?
Yeah, I think his main appeal, of course, is that, you know, the euro crisis, as it is manifesting itself in any of these countries, is essentially a cultural crisis, right? So it's a crisis in terms of, hey, we thought we had this great symbol of unity in Europe, and now we don't have it. We're actually very divided. And look, I mean, we thought it was going to bring us riches, and we have this unemployment going through the roof, and we have the economy shrinking. And politicians such as Tsipras essentially are saying, don't despair. You know, it's a very populist message. I have the solution for you. But of course, he doesn't explain what the solution is. And he just very simplistically says, we're not going to agree to all of those ugly conditions that the Europeans want to impose on us. But somehow we will get out of this, right? But he does not explain exactly how they're going to get out of this. And I think it is a pretty dangerous rhetoric to use in an election. But, of course, the message resonates with a lot of people who are very desperate because they're suffering big time through this recession.
Yeah. So people have unemployment. I was emailing with my sister yesterday. She said there are people in Greece running out of medicine, out of medication. She described a very desperate picture.
Absolutely. And I don't want to draw any dramatic parallels. But in the 1930s, we also saw the rise of populist and fascist politicians in Europe who were essentially appealing to that kind of person, that kind of voter who felt desperate, and offering them, you know, a solution without really articulating what it was. And, of course, people who were desperate voted for them because they thought, well, the conventional parties actually are not offering me any hope, right? But it's a false sense of hope, right? So I very much hope that, you know, quite frankly, he does not win, you know, enough votes to be an important player, but I'm not sure that's going to be the outcome. I mean, it's...
How is the rest of Europe looking at Greece? I see in Greece a lot of anger, seen posters of Greek people carrying pictures of Angela Merkel with a Hitler mustache and so on. There seems to be a lot of anger, but how is the rest of Europe looking at Greece?
Well, with apprehension, I think, all over, both in the countries that are doing relatively well, like Germany or Finland or the Netherlands, and also in Spain, in Portugal, in Ireland, which are the countries that are, you know, together with Greece, the most hit by the crisis. I think with apprehension and with a sense of lack of leadership. I think, you know, this episode in Europe is demonstrating that in Brussels and in Frankfurt, right, where the central bank is, there's a deficit of leadership at this moment.
Yeah. Now, we want to move on to Spain, even though we have a break coming up in a moment. So Spain just basically got a bailout, correct?
Well, yes. It has been presented as a bailout for the banks, but it is in essence a loan for the government, 100 billion euros, $125 million, intended to help the banks jumpstart credit to the economy. Whether that was going to work or not remains to be seen.
All right. We'll talk more about that bailout in just a moment. We're talking with Mauro Guillen. He is professor of international management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, where he also directs the Lauder Institute of Management and International Studies. We're talking about the crisis with the euro in the eurozone. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. What do you want to know about the situation? Have you been in Europe lately? And what was your experience? Give us a call and stay tuned to Radio Times here on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Its magical images have delighted generations. In a concert for families, Yannick Nezet-Séguin leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in scenes from Disney's Fantasia, accompanied by the iconic film and original animated scenes on a giant screen. Mickey Mouse and the Sorcerer's Apprentice, Waltzing Flowers, and more. It's all part of the Stokowski Celebration. Tickets online or 215-893-1999. Saturday, June 23rd at the Academy of Music, Disney's Fantasia in concert.
Hey, I'm Jad.
I'm Robert.
We make the show Radiolab,
which is mostly a show just for your ears.
But not anymore. Because coming soon to the Kimmel Center's Academy of Music...
A very different kind of Radiolab.
Yeah, eyeballs dancing.
Astronauts sizzling.
Holy cow.
Blind men yelling.
Sultan, you are trying to impose a visual totalitarianism upon the human brain.
Join us for Radiolab Live June 29th. Details are at radiolab.org/inthedark.
This is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. WHYY's fiscal year ends on June 30th. The last 12 months have seen the first anniversary of our Newsworks Tonight program and the 25th anniversaries of Radio Times and Fresh Air. Now is the time to lay the groundwork for the next fiscal year and beyond. I hope that you'll consider making an end-of-fiscal-year donation to WHYY before June 30th at whyy.org. Thanks.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the euro crisis and the future of the euro. And joining us is Mauro Guillen. He's professor of international management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. And we're getting calls in at 1-888-477-9499 if you want to join the conversation. And before our break, we just started talking about Spain and what exactly is happening in Spain right now? And some people are saying Spain got a better deal in terms of fixing what was happening over there. So talk about that.
Well, it remains to be seen whether the deal was better or not. But essentially, the problem in Spain was different than in Greece. So it was in some ways similar to Ireland, that is to say, a lot of real estate development that went sour, a lot of these loans for commercial developers, for families, and so on, are now bad. And, there was a big bubble, and the bubble burst. And Spain went from having a government budget surplus, right, as of 2006, 2007, to having a big deficit. And it's now actually accumulating a lot of debt. It doesn't have as much debt as Greece, but it has a big problem with unemployment, because all of those construction workers and many manufacturing jobs are now gone. And so the country's in dire straits, 23-24% unemployment, and the budget deficit, and the economy shows no signs of future growth. Yes, it is another country that required the bailout of its banks. It was presented as money for the banks, right, with the hope that if you pump money into the banks, then they will be lending to businesses, and then businesses would be investing and creating jobs.
And how much money are we talking about?
We're talking about exactly a line of credit of up to 100 billion euros, which is about $125 million. And I think most people think that the government will probably use up to about 80 billion, so about 80% of the line of credit. It's a huge amount of money. But again, the country doesn't have the resources to cope with the big problems in the banks, and some of the banks.
And where does that money come from?
Well, it comes from the European Fund, has a technical term or name. It's a European Fund, and it's a transfer to the Spanish government. So it actually adds to the future obligations of the Spanish government. But the Spanish government is hoping that the banks will do something useful with that money and will be able to return the money to the government, and then the government will return the money to Europe.
And who pays into the fund? So where did the fund come from, and how much is left at this point?
Well, that's contributions from the different European countries, and they've set up aside huge amounts of money in the neighborhood of 800 billion euros to a trillion euros for this purpose. But, it remains to be seen whether it will be enough, and whether this will be just another Band-Aid trying to, stop a major problem, right, that cannot be dealt with just a little, solutions here and there.
And who gets to decide how this fund is doled out? We always hear about Germany and Angela Merkel, but she's not the one calling those shots by herself.
I don't know. It's the European Union.
Yes.
So it's something called the Eurogroup, which is the a meeting of all of the finance or economy ministers of the various European countries, including the country that is being bailed out, that is being helped. So it is a joint European decision to give the money, and of course there are some conditions attached to that. And once again, this would be the fifth instance, because first it was Ireland, then Portugal, then Greece twice, and now there is this bailout, right? Some people call it something else, for the Spanish banks.
But people always describe Germany carrying a lot of the burden of this bailout. So can you explain Germany's role and why it appears that Angela Merkel is calling a lot of the shots, the German chancellor, and why the German people seem to say that they are carrying the weight of this whole union on their shoulders?
Yes, there are several very important reasons for this. The first is Germany is the largest economy in the European Union. Second is Germany has by far the largest surplus in terms of their relationships with the rest of the world. So it's an economy that is very competitive, that exports much more than it imports. And it's also a country that has credibility with investors. Right now, as you know, investors are buying German bonds at negative interest rates. That is to say, people are willing to give money to the German government and get back a little bit less than what they gave them, because they know that it's in safe hands, right? So Germany has credibility with the markets. But most importantly, and I think this is something that needs to be emphasized, is that the Germans did their homework. So the Germans went into the currency union in 1999 thinking, okay, now we have a currency union, we're going to, you know, become very competitive within that framework. They increased their labor productivity, right, massively, while labor productivity in Greece, in Spain, and Ireland just remained stagnant over the last 10 years, right? The Germans were already more competitive in 1999. They're now about 30 or 35 more competitive than they were back then relative to the southern Europeans. So that's why Germany, you know, is in a position to call the shots. It's large, has its house in order, has a lot of resources, and it's a very productive and competitive economy.
Let's get a call in. We have Roger joining us from Newark at 1-888-477-9499. Hi, Roger. You're on Radio Times.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Thanks, Mike. Professor, you may, will surely recall there was discussion a few months ago about a dual euro, the so-called Northern Euro versus Southern Euro, where you'd have Italy, Spain, Greece, and Portugal, primarily, maybe a couple of other countries, having a Southern Euro with a fixed exchange rate to the Northern Euro, of course, having been devalued first. Whatever happened to that idea?
It was an interesting idea, very difficult to implement. And, of course, it would be a recognition that the project of having a common currency would have failed. It was an interesting idea, technically possible, but nobody back then was really interested in implementing it, and I think today nobody's interested in implementing it either. And it would essentially create two Europes, as you mentioned, and it wouldn't really, I think, eliminate the source of the problem, which is the lack of European-wide political and fiscal mechanisms that can support a single currency.
And it also seems like it would complicate a situation that is already so complicated that it seems like very few people have a handle on this anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you would need to create a new set of rules, and who knows whether the markets would actually accept those rules and feel confident about them. What's at stake right now is whether, you know, we will be able, or Europe will be able, to continue having a single currency, or there will be a breakout, either a partial or total. And unfortunately, it seems as if we are getting closer to the moment of truth, and it could be a bad outcome.
Thank you so much for that call, Roger. And if you have a question, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation about the euro crisis. I want to get a little bit about into the whole issue of how much governments are paying out. When we're looking at euro, into the eurozone, it seems that in each country, citizens get a lot from their government. They have, you know, much paid into their health care. They have different things when they are unemployed. All that money, will that have to change? Because in France, it seemed like the voters just voted against anybody who would want to cut back on those kinds of government services.
Well, absolutely, because austerity and government cutbacks are not popular, right? They are not popular, especially in Europe, where people have a different attitude, I think, towards the role of the government and the state in the economy and in the society in terms of providing services and so on and so forth. But you see, you put your finger on a very interesting issue, which is that this is why the euro has been so difficult to keep together as a project, you know, the common currency, which is that the benefits that people get, the unemployment benefits, the healthcare benefits, all of those are different depending on the country. There's no single, really single labor market in Europe, even though you can move around. Not like in the United States. In the United States, a lot of people move around. If they don't find job in California, they move halfway across the country to find jobs. Not in Europe. There's also language barriers. This makes having a single currency very difficult because then you get stuck with a situation in which unemployment in one country is 24%, whereas in Germany, unemployment right now is actually pretty low. It's lower than in the United States. It's 6.7%. Right? So you cannot sustain a currency union when you have all of those disparities. It's not just about political union or about fiscal union. It's also about the labor market.
Did you see all of these problems coming when the euro was talked about, was introduced?
Like many other people who talk about or write about these issues, I would say yes. I mean, of course, we all thought about some of the problems, but I don't think people realized back in 1999, even though there were some very strong voices saying, you know, there are some basic fundamental flaws here. But people were very excited Again, introducing a currency that is common to all of these countries was of symbolic value, right? And it was meant to be like, something that would help promote other types of integration in Europe. And, of course, Europe, with its troubled history, this was like always thought of as a very, very fundamental and very important step. And people were discussing the benefits, but very few thought about what if something goes wrong. And, well, for 11 years it worked really well, but it has taken this massive crisis that started in 2008 for all of us, I think, to realize that there were some fundamental weaknesses, and that's what we're trying to deal with right now.
Do you think people in Europe feel united at all? I feel sometimes when Europeans are overseas, maybe they see themselves or each other as Europeans, but when we're in Europe, we don't see each other as members of the same species.
Well, of course not. There's a lot of rivalries. And the problem is that if you take a look at opinion surveys, commitment by the public to European institutions and the idea of European unity has been declining as a result of the crisis. But this is normal, right? Every crisis, I think, promotes these more nationalistic and more, locally driven kinds of, behaviors, right? That's another reason to be concerned about, the future of Europe and the future of the euro, which is that popular support for European integration and for the common currency has been eroding because, of course, people are saying, hey, I'm unemployed, and I wasn't unemployed before this. So what is it in the euro, for me, right? They're asking that question, of course.
I want to talk a little bit about France, where the power just shifted. And, of course, Sarkozy was always a big ally for Angela Merkel and was always partnering in terms of austerity measures. And they kind of had this common course. They were also known as Merkozy, the power couple. So what's going to happen now?
Well, Hollande, the new president, hasn't really told us or told the French what is it that he has in mind in order to revive the euro or to revive the economy. He's asking for more stimulus, and I think that's another topic that deserves discussion. And he has made a proposal last week. Nobody has really paid attention about some kind of euro bond that is not really a euro bond. So the idea that a country could issue debt, but it would be guaranteed by all of the member states, which is, of course, what Germany resists, right, and doesn't want to accept. So I think Hollande has been in power for about a month, hasn't really defined himself. He has changed a couple of things. He has appointed ministers. But quite frankly, I don't think he has a good solution to the problem because France is also in a situation in which it doesn't have a lot of slack. It doesn't have a lot of room, to make, things happen, even within their own economy, which is not doing great either.
Right. Yeah. Let's take another call. We have Barbara joining us from Philadelphia. Hi, Barbara. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
My husband is from Croatia, and they are on the waiting list to join the European Union next July 2013. And I'm wondering, with the crisis, what impact will this have on the countries in the stream to join it? And whether what your sense is how beneficial it would be for these countries to be joining the European Union with the crisis going on?
Thank you, Barbara. That's a great question. Is it still a popular club to get into at this point?
Well, obviously, there are, I think, two sides to that question. Joining the common currency right now is totally out of the question, right? I mean, the currency, I mean, we're talking here, we're discussing, everybody's debating the future or the survival of the currency. Another matter is the European Union, in terms of a trade bloc in which there are no restrictions to the free movement of goods and services and the free movement of people. You see, I think the British, in all of their pragmatism, have always gotten it right, which is we want to take advantage of that free movement of goods and services and the free movement of people, but we're a little bit reluctant to join a currency union, right? So I think countries like Croatia, small economy, highly dependent on other economies for investment, also for markets. It has everything, to benefit in terms of being a member of a trade bloc, such as the European Union, from, the free movement of goods and services and money and investment. Whether Croatia or any other country at this point would like or would, see any benefits in joining the euro, I think is highly dubious, right? So I think we need to distinguish between the two things, right? So a country like Croatia stands to benefit from free trade in the context of Europe. Otherwise, it would be very isolated, right? Small economy. But, of course, I think joining the common currency system, I think it's, you know, it's just not something that they should pursue at this point, obviously.
And can you do one without the other,
clarify? Oh, yes. There are 27 members of the European Union, and only 17, right, decided over the last few years to either as a foundational member or subsequently to become members of the euro system.
So going forward, you don't see a lot of countries joining in on the euro?
Well, why would you like to join a currency whose status and future is in doubt, right? Right now, I mean, it's better to, you know, just think about other things to do.
So was the euro a bad idea?
Look, I think it is a good idea from the point of view of bringing together all of these countries, of deepening their union. Again, a currency plays a role in the economy as a medium of exchange, as a reserve, as a store of value, and so on and so forth. But it is also a symbolic thing. So again, the Europeans maybe put the cart ahead of the horse, thinking, oh, having a common currency will help us accomplish other things. And maybe what we realize is that they should have accomplished other things like fiscal unification and political union before launching the currency. Having said that, once again, if we go back to Germany, Germany did its homework. If Greece and Spain and Italy and Portugal and Ireland and the other countries had done their homework, had increased their productivity during the boom times, right, over the last 10 years, like Germany did, we wouldn't have this problem here. Because once again, Germany increased their productivity by 30% or so.
But
the others stayed behind.
There were supposed to be measures making sure that a country was kind of up to speed before they could join in.
Yes, but those were, you know, essentially a couple of tests. One is that your budget deficit should be less than 3% of GDP, your cumulative debt less than 60% of GDP, right, your stock of debt. But you know what? The first two countries to actually exceed those limits were France and Germany. France, because it had some economic problems in 2005. Germany, because it was having trouble incorporating East Germany, right, into the unified federal republic. So those criteria really didn't work. But they weren't about competitiveness. They weren't about productivity. They were just pure technical criteria about government deficit and the amount of government debt. And we know that once a country or an economy gets into a recession, you know, the government gets into debt and the government gets into trouble, right? Because they have to pay unemployment benefits because they don't have as much tax revenue and so on and so forth. So I don't think those criteria were effective or relevant in the first place. And secondly, the really important thing is once you have the same currency, you have to stay competitive. And if one country, i.e. Germany, the largest economy, is like improving every day, becoming even more competitive, and the others are lagging behind, that's a recipe for disaster. So it took, you know, 10 years for those problems to manifest themselves.
And we'll talk more about the euro crisis in just a moment. We do have a break coming up. Our number here at Radio Times is 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. If you have a question about the future of the euro and the eurozone, give us a call. We're talking with Mauro Guillen. He's professor of international management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. We'll talk more in just a moment. I want to get back to France for a second and then also look to solutions and to what could work in the eurozone and how this whole thing could be salvaged. Stay tuned to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Chestnut Hill College takes a holistic approach designed to inspire a passion of learning and a rewarding educational experience. The Chestnut Hill College School of Graduate Studies. Chestnut Hill College supports WHYY.
Henry Hill, the former mobster portrayed by Ray Liotta in the film Goodfellas, died Tuesday. On the next Fresh Air, we'll listen back to an interview with Nick Pileggi, who wrote the book about Hill's life, Wise Guy, which he adapted into the movie Goodfellas. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Sammy Wanjiru revolutionized the marathon, but his death is a cautionary tale about running and drinking. Also, what did Mitt Romney say about health care reform when he was governor? Well, newly discovered emails reveal a very different story than the one we're hearing today. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Focus Features, presenting the new film Moonrise Kingdom, directed by Wes Anderson and starring Bruce Willis, Edward Norton, Bill Murray, Frances McDormand, and Tilda Swinton. Moonrise Kingdom, in select theaters now.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the Euro, once holding so much promise and introduced with so much fanfare and now potentially doomed, leaving Europe in crisis. Our guest is Mauro Guillen. He's a professor of international management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, where he directs the Lauder Institute of Management and International Studies. Mauro Guillen, which countries are doing okay right now out of the 17 in the Eurozone? How many hands do you need?
just one hand.
Yeah.
Germany is doing okay, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Could do better because it does export a lot to some of the countries that are depressed. The Netherlands, Finland, there's maybe three or four countries. Austria, they're mm-hmm. doing okay. All of them, of course, in Central or Northern Europe.
And is that enough to keep this going?
No, of course not.
Yeah.
I mean, Europe has a big problem now with economic growth, with unemployment, with the state of the banks. And, of course, the consequences for Europe are clear, but the consequences for the overall global economy, I think, are also potentially harmful.
And I want to get to that in just a moment. By the way, if you want to join us, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 if you want to join the conversation. So what are the consequences if we think about, let's say, the euro, worst case scenario, euro falls apart? So what happens in Europe and what happens over here?
Well, in Europe, it's going to take a while to sort out the mess, because mm-hmm. there's going to be all of these contracts specified in euros, and suddenly the euro doesn't exist. There's going to be a lot of pain in the short run in the peripheral countries, more unemployment, more of a recession. There's going to be a lot of confusion. The markets, of course, investors would lose confidence. Now, the consequences of that for the United States or for Latin America or for China or India, all of these countries export to the European Union. The European Union is the largest market in the world. American companies have huge investments in Europe. American companies make large amounts of profits in Europe. All of that will evaporate, at least for a while. So we really don't want here in the United States a European meltdown. That's the last thing that we want, because it would essentially make it harder for the American economy to get out of this mini slowdown that we're going through right now, and it would make it harder to create jobs in the United States.
Yeah. Who has the most skin in the game in Europe to keep holding on to the euro?
Well, some people argue that it's Germany,
mm-hmm.
right? Because Germany is, after all, an economy that is not self-sufficient. It's an economy that needs to export. And about one-third of Germany's exports go to the rest of Europe. So Germany has a lot at stake. The voters, though, in Germany are not yet ready to say, hey, here's a check, let's fix the problem once and for all. They don't want to do that. But essentially, all of each European country has right now a vested interest in finding a solution that is not a breakout, right, a breakup of the euro, because that would once again generate a lot of pain in the short run. It mm-hmm. would be a very difficult situation.
And of course, with the euro crisis, we've talked a lot about austerity measures. And some economists, I read one comment that said, austerity measures are to the economy what bleeding is to medicine. So there are completely opposed viewpoints on austerity measures. What's your take?
Well, I think I agree with that line of thinking. I mean, the problem is you have four kinds of actors in the economy. You have banks, you have businesses, you have households, and you have governments. Banks and businesses and households right now, families, are up to their necks in terms of debt, or they have major problems. They cannot really do anything to help the economy. The government is the only actor that has some leeway there, because they can, spend more. They can borrow, right? Even though some of these countries, of course, as we've been discussing, don't have that capacity. But there are other countries in Europe that could, like Germany, help them borrow more money and stimulate. So if the government also engages in austerity measures, and all it does is cut the budget and reduce its own demand for goods and services, we're just reinforcing that cycle, right? of decline and depression, right, of these economies. So that's why many economists are now arguing, some of them have been arguing this for 2 or 3 years, the government needs to be more proactive. We need growth first, and then austerity will come later. But again, there are some other experts and some politicians who say, no, we want austerity first because we don't believe that the government will eventually, you know, balance its own accounts. So this is the big debate right now. And of course, both in Europe and the United States, those in favor of austerity so far are winning. And that's why I think the problems persist.
Can you do both at the same time? Can you do stimulus and cut some spending?
Well, I think you can make some trade-offs over time. So you can say, let's try to grow the economy a little bit faster in the hope that then that will raise tax revenue and the government will find it easier to balance its books, right? So you have to make some trade-offs over time. It's not a question of what are we doing tomorrow, one or the other, or a combination of both. I think it's you need to think in terms of what are we going to do over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years. So I am of the opinion, and so I'm in agreement with those other economists or experts that you mentioned, that we need to grow the economy. We need to do more in that respect, with the hope that then governments will be, let's say, in 3 or 4 years from now, in a better position to balance their books. But once again, not everybody is in agreement, mm-hmm. and right now the other side seems to be winning.
I guess on some level, to a layperson, it feels like I'm in Atlantic City, I've lost $10,000, and now I'm going back and I'm borrowing $20,000 and going back to the blackjack table. I mean, it has that kind of panic-inducing feeling to it on some level.
Well, of course. If you think about it in those terms, then the answer is obvious, which is, yeah, the government should balance its books right now, tomorrow. Right?
Yeah.
But the problem is dynamic. The problem unfolds over time, and the solution also should unfold over time, right? So once again, we need to get these economies growing again, because otherwise, you know, we're going to have a lost generation of young people. In some of these European countries, nearly 50% of people under the age of 25, working age people, are jobless. I mean, this is not a situation that is sustainable. So you need to break that dynamic. You need to bring it to an end. And that's why I think there's increasingly these voices calling for governments to do more. And as you know, the Federal Reserve has indicated yesterday that they may be discussing another round of stimulus in the form of monetary easing, right? Because they feel that the recovery here in the United States is losing steam, right?
Mm-hmm. On a really practical level, what could a country like Greece, what could they get into? You talked about they had a shipping industry that's declining. They have the opportunity for a really booming tourism industry, have a lot of competition. What could they do?
Well, that's the problem.
Yeah.
That they have very few options in the short run.
Mm-hmm.
Longer run, the only way out, of course, is to work harder in terms of increasing their productivity and increasing their competitiveness. In the short run, they need help, and this is why they've been bailed out twice. If they were to get out of the euro, then, of course, they would have a devalued national currency, the drachma, and that would help them compete, right? Because suddenly everything made in Greece would be so much cheaper. But that's not the way. Well, we'll see on Sunday. That doesn't seem to be the way Greece as a country wants to go. And certainly the rest of Europe doesn't want Greece to necessarily exit the euro, right? But yeah, the options are very, very limited. And they are limited because, once again, for 10 years, or in Greece's case, perhaps even longer, they haven't been doing what they were expected to be doing, they should have been doing in terms of becoming more competitive.
Let's take another call. We have Ben joining us from Philadelphia. Hi, Ben. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Hello.
Question. I've been to Europe a couple of times. I've been to Italy and France, and I can tell you that the lira was a pleasure, and the euro is a terrible thing to have to live on if you're going to buy anything there. But my two-part question is, one is the financialization of the markets that has taken place since 2007, the absence of any regulation, such as during the Clinton with the Glass-Steagall Act, and, of course, the Dodd-Frank Act, which is really not a very good indicator of regulations on the economy, and two, I hope I was clear, and two, what role did Goldman Sachs have in arranging a number of the debt offerings, especially to Greece?
What role the what has? I'm sorry.
Did Goldman Sachs have in structuring the debt offerings, especially to Greece?
Okay.
Back in 2007, 2008?
All right, let's pose that question to Professor Guillen.
Yeah, so Ben, so I think the first question is by far the more important one.
So,
banking regulation is obviously a very important thing. I mean, you have to get it right. Banks play a very important role in any economy. And again, the problem right now is that in most of these European countries, the banks are not lending. They don't have enough money. Even if they had the money, new regulations are asking them to keep more of that money in the form of reserves. So therefore, businesses cannot get credit. And as a result of that, there's little investment and there's not enough job creation and so on and so forth. So some of the money from these bailouts is meant to essentially, disrupt that dynamic and try to get the credit flowing again to businesses, right? And I would agree with you that some of the regulations perhaps that have been introduced, and perhaps including some of the aspects of the Frank Dodd legislation in the United States, maybe should be relaxed for a while until the economy actually starts growing again. I think there is some sense of that. Now, to the second question, what I would say is that I think, and a little bit of a link to the first question, I think there's an increasing realization here that we do need to keep an eye, not necessarily regulate, but certainly supervise and keep an eye on exactly what investment banks do in general and how they do it. And, of course, we need to police any conflict of interest and any instance in which, on the one hand, they're doing something for a client, but then on the other, they're betting against that client, right? So those are all, I think, types of behaviors that should be eliminated through regulation and through supervision, because otherwise we've learned over the last 4 years that they can cause a lot of harm, and not just in Greece, but also here in the United States.
Yeah. Thank you for that call, Ben. And Mauro Guillen, I want to ask you again about a little bit about the future of Europe. And what do you see any emerging industries that give you hope, where you see, oh, there's this happening in Spain or this is happening in Italy that could really provide a boost?
Oh, sure. I mean, let's, remember that Europe is not a, developing part of the world. I mean,
no,
this is a set of very rich economies. People in Europe live well, mm-hmm. right, in general. And why do they live well? They don't have that much by way of natural resources. They live well because they have well-educated populations and they have competitive industries. But many of these industries, and especially in some of these countries, have lost competitiveness over the last 10 years, 15 years, and so on and so forth. So they need to regain that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they have all of the ingredients. They just need to, get their house in order. And, of course, they need to overcome this big problem with the euro. Right now, which is, of course, making it very hard for some of the economies to adjust to this new global economy. And, of course, these are small countries, Greece, Portugal, Ireland, even Spain, right, that will need help from outside and will need time to adjust. But the Europeans do have the ingredients to be competitive. They just need to rethink the way in which they play a role in the global economy.
Mm. And when you say getting the house in order and increasing competitiveness, what plays a role in that? You said Germany did some things right. What exactly did they, what are some things that they did?
Well, they essentially, kept the growth in wages in check.
Mm-hmm.
They encouraged companies and workers to become more productive, right? So every hour of work, they would actually produce more. And they did this in a sustained way. You cannot just do it for one day or a couple of weeks. You need to do this over a period of years. And that's, when you get the results. But in the short run, one thing that I would say is that Germany, given that it is in such a strong position right now financially and also in terms of its competitiveness, they could help by buying more goods and services from the periphery of Europe. They could help by stimulating their own spending. And this is something that they've also been resisting a little bit. I think on this one, they could be a little bit more flexible and allow a little bit more of inflation in Germany, a little bit more of wage growth, in the hope that when the German public has, German consumers have more money in their pockets, then they would buy more goods and they would spend more days on vacation in Greece, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which would help the Greek economy. So Germany can play a very constructive role. At the same time, they cannot fix all of the problems, right? The Greek problems, the Spanish problems, the Italian problems, they need to be fixed by the Italians, by the Greeks, and by the Spaniards.
Yeah. And a lot of, I guess, the future of Europe rests on the shoulders of young people. a lot of whom are unemployed right now. So there must be that sense of hopelessness, for example, in Spain, where so many young people are unemployed.
About 50%. Yeah. There's a lot of frustration. And this is bad because, of course, young people is the workforce of the future and is the voters of the future. And if they believe that these democracies in Europe, and remember, some of these countries didn't have a democracy 40 years ago. Greece was run by the dictator, so was Spain, so was Portugal 40 years ago. If the young people lose faith in the ability of the democratic elected government to fix these problems, to give them a job, I think this can have very bad, you know, long-term consequences. And people are going to become, I think, you know, very distrustful of government and even of democracy.
Yeah. And we're coming up toward the end of our hour together here. You have said before that the situation in Europe is delicate, but there's no need to panic. So in closing, what are your thoughts going forward? How much is staked on Sunday's election? And what's your general sense of what's going to happen?
Now, Sunday's election is, of course, pivotal.
Uh-huh.
Everybody, including, of course, investors, have realized this is a turning point. I think we are reaching the point of no return. And essentially, if the markets don't warm up to buying European debt in the next month or so, I think the risk of the euro falling apart is actually very high. Europe, and in particular Germany, has the ability to stop that. But whether they're willing to pay the cost of doing so, I think that that's the big question, right? So they could stop it by making, for example, the European Central Bank the lender of last resort by guaranteeing all of the debt. They don't want to do that because, of course, they think in doing so they would be condoning bad habits from the past.
Yeah, so I guess we'll have to talk again soon to see what happens on Sunday and to see what it all means. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Mauro Guillen is professor of international management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, where he also directs the Lauder Institute for Management and International Studies. Thank you so much for joining us for this hour on the euro crisis and everything that is happening in Europe. We will be following that story going forward, and especially after Monday and the elections in Greece. Stay tuned here to WHYY in Philadelphia. We have another hour of Radio Times coming right up.